The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 27th of March 2023 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. Hello there and a very warm welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Emma Nelson and coming up in the next 30 minutes. Widespread protest in Israel after Benjamin Netanyahu fires his defence minister for pushing back against controversial reforms. We'll have the latest. Also ahead, US Vice President Kamala Harris makes an historic trip to Africa, countering Chinese influence is high on the agenda. Then a day of strikes in Germany. We'll examine why workers at airports, railways, buses and metro lines are all walking out. And then Monocle's Fernanda Augusto-Pacheco will be joining me in the studio to tell us what's in the paper. Faye, give us a taste of what's to come.
Hello, Emma. Today we discuss the return of the Buenos Aires Herald, plus some cultural highlights from Milan.
Thank you very much indeed. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson. The decision by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to fire his defence minister this weekend has been met with widespread protest. Tens of thousands of people flooded the streets after Yoav Gallant voiced his opposition to plans to change the judiciary. Opponents of the scheme fear it'll mark a dangerous erosion of democracy. Well, let's cross live now to Tel Aviv, where we can hear from Alison Kaplan-Sommer, who's a journalist at the Haaretz newspaper. A very good afternoon to you, Alison.
Good afternoon.
So just tell us what happened in your city last night.
When the news broke that Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, who is a Likud member and has been a loyalist to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was fired by Netanyahu for the crime of speaking out against the judicial reform package, Gallant said, who is a supporter of the package, but he said that the dissonance that it's causing in the public, specifically in the military, by members of the military who are opposed to this judicial overhaul and say that they will no longer volunteer for important service if it is passed. He called for a halt to it, and for his disloyalty, he was fired by Netanyahu. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for much of the Israeli public, whether or not they support the reforms. They are disturbed by this kind of behavior on the part of Netanyahu and feel that he, not only are they fearing that the legislation he's pushing could lead to a dictatorship, they feel like he's behaving like a dictator for firing one of his top and most important ministers simply for speaking out. So there was a spontaneous call to head out to the streets, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in total, of Israelis all over the country, mostly focused on Tel Aviv, but in my town, which is about a city of 80,000, there are also thousands of people in the streets. And this happened at 10 p.m., 11 p.m., midnight, 1 a.m., there were people on the streets waving flags, chanting for democracy and to halt this package of judicial legislation that the Netanyahu government has been pushing at lightning speed through the parliament.
What was it like? Because the scene that you describe is one not only of a huge swell, but of a spontaneous one, which clearly indicates the strength and sort of immediacy of feeling that people are experiencing here.
A lot of people have been incredibly disturbed. They have not been able to sleep. This is a country that was conceived with an idea, and it's a very idealistic, ideologically driven country. So when you feel as if your prime minister is violating the very basis on which your country is built, it's caused disturbances. I've seen in people that from the worst wars that Israel has fought, they haven't seemed this upset or involved in what's going on. The scenes on the street, they range from a feeling of a street festival. People are encouraged by being together with other people who feel as strongly as they do. So I would say the majority of the demonstrations have an upbeat feeling, but there's also an undercurrent of fury. And in the center of the storm in Tel Aviv, where there's many, many young people, where many of the hardcore leaders of the protest movement are centered. Last night, there were burning tires on the main highway going through the city. There was more of an atmosphere, for example, of what you see in the streets of France, much more militant and much more violent. But I would say, you know, up until now, with a few exceptions, there have been every sector of society showing up for these demonstrations. It hasn't been only political radicals. It has really been an everyman's demonstration.
So what does this mean now for Benjamin Netanyahu, who has clearly done something that has tipped his citizens into a fresh and dangerous position? What can he do now?
He's in the very definition of between a rock and a hard place, because he is a clever politician and he sees this as unsustainable. You have a general strike underway. You have the hospitals and the healthcare system shutting down. There are no outgoing flights from the airport right now. They're shutting down entire malls. I was joking that if Israelis can't go shopping and can't travel abroad, you're really going to have a revolution. McDonald's is closed. You can't buy a hamburger at McDonald's. So really, the country is turning against him. And yet, he needs political survival, and some of his key coalition partners really want these reforms to go through. So he is trying to have to walk a tightrope between the public mood and trying to stay in political power and keep his coalition together. I think what is probably one of the biggest concerns on his mind, he, as we know, is engaged in a criminal trial for bribery and corruption. His personal lawyer said that if these judicial overhauls continue, he is going to resign and he is no longer going to defend Netanyahu in court. So Netanyahu really almost has no choice but to back down from these judicial changes, from the overhaul. But he has to try to do so without paying the complete political cost, which would be to lose power if his coalition partners are angry enough to pull out of his coalition over this.
And now we have the Israeli president telling Netanyahu to just, you know, I think he said, come to your senses right now. Mm-hmm. Is this a matter of time now before Benjamin Netanyahu has to rein these reforms in? And if it does, how much damage does that do to him politically?
I think if Netanyahu was going to come to his senses, he would have done so already. He's been handed many ladders to climb down from the proverbial tree. And as one of our columnists, Anshel Pfeffer, wrote, he not only decided not to climb down the ladder, but he pulled down the ladder, threw it on the ground, doused it with gasoline and set it on fire. So he's been very defiant till now. He is maybe being forced to at least take a pause in this campaign for the judicial reforms. But he is not going to really back down for them unless he's forced to, unless he's dragged into doing so. It appears that that may be what's happening today.
And what is interesting, I know that you've commented in the last few hours about the fact it's one thing to fear dictatorship, it's another to see your leaders behaving like dictators. That is a very strong it's a very strong image that you're talking about here.
When I've spoken to people, I just returned from a demonstration. I was speaking to the demonstrators, and they were really appalled. I spoke to one man who had not gone to a demonstration until now. The fact that the defense minister was fired for speaking his mind, that he was fired for having an opinion that was based on experts, on top military officials. The commander-in-chief of the IDF thinks this is dangerous. The head of the Mossad and the Secret Services has said that this judicial revolution is dangerous. He was only saying what the best and the brightest of Israel have been saying. And the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu chose to fire him for expressing his opinion, that smells of dictatorship, and that has turned off a great deal of the Israeli public that actually, you know, in fact, doesn't have a big problem with the judicial reforms as they stand. But the behavior of Netanyahu is what is bringing people out into the streets right now.
Alison Kaplan-Summer on the line from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 12:08. Let's get the latest headlines. Here's Marcus Hippie.
Thanks, Emma. Former Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou left for China today on a landmark trip, saying he hoped to bring about peace and improve relations through the interactions of young people. Ma, who was in office from 2008 to 2016, is the first former or current Taiwanese president to visit China since the defeated Republic of China government fled to Taiwan in 1949. Lawmakers in the US will move forward with legislation to address national security worries about TikTok, alleging China's government had access to the short video app's user data. In the United States, there are growing calls to ban the app, owned by China-based company ByteDance. And airports and bus and train stations across Germany are experiencing one of the largest walkouts in decades as Europe's biggest economy reels from inflation. The 24-hour strikes called by unions were the latest in months of industrial action, which has hit major European economies as higher food and energy prices dent living standards. We'll be hearing more about this story a bit later in the programme. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Emma.
Thank you, Marcus. And we will be crossing to Germany in a few moments to get the latest on those strikes. But first, the US Vice President Kamala Harris is embarking upon a tour of Africa this week, a trip which carries huge amounts of significance when it comes to both the past and the future. She is the first black woman vice president to visit Africa, and she'll be doing so at a time when there is a real chance that China may well be beating the US in terms of influence. Well, Scott Lucas is adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin and a monocled regular voice. I'm delighted to have him on the line this afternoon. Good afternoon, Scott. Welcome.
Very good afternoon to you, Emma.
The first question you need to ask is, why has this actually taken Kamala Harris so long to do this? Because it is a huge visit, isn't it?
It's a significant visit. And in terms of Kamala specifically, you know, that's a really good question. And I think you'd have to ask the Biden administration folks why, given, you know, her historic role as being the first vice president, black American vice president, why she hasn't been at the forefront of the African policy, not just because she's black, but because she's extremely competent, because she's a great ambassador for the United States. That said, the Biden administration in the last 3 months, this will be the fifth high-level visit in that time period, including a visit by Anthony Blinken just a few weeks ago, Niger as one of the two countries, Niger and I think Ethiopia was the other country he went to. And the fact is that the Biden administration are now putting a much more visible priority on Africa. You can say that's because of the challenge from China and Russia, and that's certainly true. But one would hope it's also because the Biden administration is realizing, look, Africa just simply isn't this neglected continent that all of a sudden, you know, you pop onto our screens every so often to say, oh, yeah, we'd still like some economic benefit from working with you.
So she's going to Ghana, Tanzania, and Zambia. What does she hope to achieve there?
Well, the first thing will be photo opportunities. And I got to be honest with you, because the fact just is the Chinese have tried to get photo opportunities in terms of their economic projects. The Russians tried to get photo opportunities with Sergei Lavrov going on two different trips to Africa within the past 2 months. You know, you want that visibility of showing, look, there are U.S.-African ties. But I think beyond that, I think there will be discussions in terms of, right, let's make this meaningful in terms of an economic relationship. If we're talking about U.S. investment in Africa, which will be the word that they'll put out there, investment, what does that investment mean? More substantially, let's highlight this isn't just one-way traffic. It's not just the Chinese and the Russians getting involved in Africa. For example, the African Continental Free Trade Area, which started at January 1st, 2022. 47 of 55 African countries have now ratified the agreement. Seven others have signed it, and ratification is hoped to occur this year. Let's get that free trade area moving. What does that mean in terms of African countries trading with each other and not just simply with a relationship with the U.S.? And then beyond the economic issues, what are the political issues in terms of governance and stability, where we don't just simply look at Africa when we notice it as being some country which has suddenly erupted in civil war or where you've had, you know, conflict between countries. Let's talk about the long-term stability of governance and reliability as part of the international community.
But when you talk about that, you are doing so in a, at a moment when the influence from countries such as China and indeed Russia are already significant. One of the examples that's being mentioned is the fact that when Kamala Harris flies into Zambia, when she touches down in Lusaka, that airport was financed and designed by Chinese money. And you already have fears that governments are already beholden to Chinese, to China, making life for them incredibly difficult to try and forge that future that you were talking about a moment ago.
Stop treating it as a competition. I mean, that would be my advice here. And I know that's difficult to say because everything we frame in terms of our headlines are U.S.-Chinese tensions or tensions with the Russians because of the Ukraine war and because of their activities in Africa. But once you treat everything as a competition, which is, well, you can't take any investment from China, for example, then you do two things. One is you highlight this as an issue of conflict rather than cooperation. And secondly, you enable countries, or at least individuals within countries, to leverage themselves, to trade you off against the Chinese. Fact of the matter is China's pursuing an alternative economic system. We know that. We know that they're doing it for their interest. But the U.S. doesn't have to walk in there and say, oh, look, choose us or Beijing. What you should, I think, be saying to African countries is, what is it that would benefit you in terms of developing yourself, your communities, and your region? And how can we be part of that? Take that as your starting point, rather than making this some type of new economic cold war.
How much faith is there, though, in the U.S. administration to do this? I mean, the direct comparisons are being made between Kamala Harris's visit to Africa and when Barack Obama went, and that the swell and the joy at his arrival was huge. But later on, there are accusations that the promises that were made, the pledges that were made, we're just kept on the sidelines, and America is good at arriving, making a good statement, and then going again.
As has been the case, I'm afraid, for decades. And you can go all the way back, for example, to the 1950s, when the Eisenhower administration finally, I think, recognized Africa with an Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. But what did it mean in terms of, you know, actually positive ties, in terms of economic, social, and political progress? I think you have to hold your hand up if you're an American official and recognize, yeah, the America hasn't delivered, or when it has been involved in Africa, it's been the idea that Africa serves an American purpose. So you have to change that narrative, and you have to do so with meaningful action, not just with slogans. But at the same time, you know, the idea that the Chinese and the Russians are benevolent in Africa, that's certainly not the case. I can give you a whole checklist of disappointment over Chinese involvement in Africa, where projects haven't been completed or where the Chinese have taken over the projects and have seemed to be self-serving. Go back to the idea that you have movements for African economic communities, which are developing, which are providing new opportunities, that you have developments in governance and in terms of your, you know, African countries trying to build themselves up in terms of stable societies. Make yourself part of that instead of making this like a history of imperialism or colonialism that you have to simply foreground. I'm not saying these things didn't occur, but in other words, let's make this a matter of what the U.S. is going to do in 2023, not for Washington, but as part of a partnership with African countries, and Kamala Harris should be part of that.
Scott Lucas, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You with The Briefing.
You asked, we delivered. Welcome to The Concierge, a travel show from Monocle, brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. This week, we explore the delights of Helsinki's most fascinating food and drink destinations.
I really love this place. You could come here any time of the evening and eat something small, eat a long dinner, have an expensive bottle of great wine, or just one glass of something simple.
And travel to St. Moritz for ski season without the skis.
The ice is melting, but I am told that it's at a safe 45 centimetres. So even though I'm standing in a puddle, I think everyone is going to be okay.
The Concierge, in association with Allianz Partners. Listen via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your audio.
You're back with The Briefing live on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Now, try to embark upon a journey in Germany today and you may well struggle. Workers at airports, ports, railways, buses and metro lines are taking part in a widespread 24-hour stoppage. Well, joining us for more down the line from Munich is Bastian Brinkmann, Deputy Head of Economics at the Süddeutsche Zeitung. And the man, Bastian, I understand, had to rely on two wheels to get about today. Is that correct? Welcome.
Hello. Yeah, it's my usual ride into the office on the bike, but it was a very rainy, frosty morning and there was no alternative, no bus for me to take because the strike.
So you were joined on the road, I imagine, by lots and lots of different people. I mean, just explain to us who is striking and why are they striking?
Yeah, there are two unions combining their powers to stop this country successfully today. This is kind of unusual. Normally, unions don't team up and don't see each other as common players in a common fight. But this one, they did it.
Just explain to us what they're striking about. It seems to be sort of a general malaise about many problems that many of us are also experiencing.
That's true. The reason is 8%, and 8% is the inflation figure from last year and still going on above 8% still last month in Germany. So energy prices are really biting consumers, biting companies, and biting into people's wages. So last year, Germany is traditionally very afraid of inflation. So last year, the unions held back. They actually were very low in their demands and got the demands more or less fulfilled. But this year they say now it's time for payback because workers took a real cut and it's actually true. And that's why they are asking for very high demands. That's why the two unions teamed up and said, now's the time to really raise wages.
The unions have said that there is no point in doing a strike unless there is a sting to it. How is this affecting, how has this gone down in Germany?
I expected a lot of fellow traffic on the roads. A colleague of mine didn't get into the office before noon because she expected Munich to be on full traffic jam. Actually, many people turned to stay in the home office today and work from home. Of course, it's not an option for everybody, but the people who were able to do it and maybe the rain on Monday morning helped as well. To let people stay inside.
What's been the reception, though, to the strike? There is a sort of a popular support of it, or are people angry?
It's a mixed result, of course, depending on whether you're stuck in traffic or not. Or some people, also airports are on strike. So I know somebody who was stuck in New York or San Francisco, probably worst places in the world to get stuck. But still, that can mix up your plans. Apart from that, the energy prices, everybody experienced that. So I think that helps the public support for the unions quite a long way because everybody had to pay hundreds of euros more for the energy bills, or at least many people. It was a very pre-scheduled plan. So nobody was taken by surprise. Everybody had several days to plan ahead and to think and to reschedule and to move to Zoom meetings instead of real meetings and to postpone doctor's visits if you had one upcoming. So it was still a German strike in that sense, that it was very orderly and pre-planned and pre-announced.
What is the economic effect on what is, Germany is Europe's biggest economy? This will hurt.
Yeah, but a one-day strike, it's not nothing. But the bigger question, I think, is what will the wage situation be? Because you can only choose between bad options. Not giving the workers a hefty raise in pay will be bad, will lead to dissatisfaction, will maybe even lead to political anger. And you need quite the opposite with war support for Ukraine and energy prices and energy diversification and investments in new energy. You need public support for that. And on the other hand, if you raise wages too fast and too much, of course, you create the next inflation spiral. Germany had this in the 70s and 80s, this German history with high inflation, also due to too high demands and too long strikes and too intense union bargaining. And everybody in Germany has this history in mind and is very careful that the unions are not overdoing it.
So you mentioned a moment ago, and in the context that this is a rare move, but we are seeing strikes absolutely everywhere across Europe at least. Is this a sign of the shape of things to come, that we will get more used to talking about Germany and German workers going on strike?
Yeah, that will be the European labour movement maybe resurfacing. I'm not so sure, because I think there is So the unions are this time demanding public servers and the train company, which is essentially public in Germany as well. And the public in the end still has some money. So it's taxpayers' money that they are spending, but they can pay up. They can raise wages if they want to and if it's economically and politically sustainable. But politically it is, and economically you have to find the right balance between compensating for inflation and not fueling the next inflation cycle. But there's middle ground there, and you can meet it. That's why I think Germany is, for German terms, on a rough patch, but compared to France, this will still be a mild strike season, I assume.
Bastian Brinkmann, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Briefing. Finally on today's show, we flick through the day's newspapers with Monocle's Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. Welcome, Faye.
Hello, Emma. How are you doing?
Well, normally we're talking about a global countdown.
Yes, but today we have serious news, although the global countdown, I think, is very serious as well.
Incredibly serious.
It's very serious.
All we talk about. Tell us about what's in the papers. Let's go to Folha São Paulo.
Let's start in Folha de São Paulo in Brazil. And in fact, I want to give you an update because I was here Friday on The Briefing talking about Lula's trip to China, the expectation, how important it was because China is Brazil's largest trading partner. But the trip had to be cancelled because Lula, at the moment, he's got what he says, mild pneumonia. And, you know, it's viral. I mean, he doesn't want to meet Xi Jinping and kind of spread virus in China as
well. That wouldn't go down very well.
That wouldn't go down very well. But it's very difficult because 200 people were going with Lula and his delegation. So a lot of business people in Brazil. So it was going to be a very important trip. So at the moment, there's no new date. And there was a funny story that Jair Bolsonaro is finally returning to Brazil on the 30th of March, so just in a few days' time. And he decided to come back on that day because Lula wouldn't be in Brazil. That's how petty he is. So I wonder if Bolsonaro will postpone his trip as well and wait for Lula. It sounds very crazy.
Or he might well find himself on a plane to Beijing.
Who knows?
The China-Brazil relationship, just sort of summarize it for us, would you?
It's incredibly important. I mean, China, especially their technology firms, they depend on Brazil and Brazil vice versa as well. I mean, just remember when Brazil was growing in the noughties, that's because China was buying our commodities as well. So it's at the moment, I think Lula's probably looking more to Beijing than to Washington, although he did meet Biden this year. But some people said that their meeting was okay, perhaps a little bit frostier than expected. So it's quite interesting to see. But yeah, it's a very important, business connection between both countries.
Okay. Let's move on to a lovely story out of Argentina, the return of a newspaper. Always good to hear that. Sadly a rarity, but a joyful bit of news.
Exactly. Very joyful. The Buenos Aires Herald is back indeed. And Emma, just so you have an idea, they are one of the most influential English language papers in the region. They were found by a Scottish immigrant in 1876. And the paper had a very strong journalistic purpose in Argentina. During the military dictatorship, it was one of the few voices of the opposition. So they were talking about the people that were disappearing out of nowhere in Argentina. So it has an amazing history. So yes, the paper closed in 2017 because of financial difficulties. And at the moment, they are back as a daily online format. We might see a return to print, but we're not sure yet. But it's very good news for the region.
What's brought it back?
Well, I think there was an interest for it as well. And it got kind of, new investors as well. And as I said, they have an amazing history. I think they wouldn't let the brand die in such a way. I think it's very good. There's positive stories there. And I would love to see it back in print.
I'd be delighted to see it too. Let's head to Italy. You fell off a plane from Milan yesterday, didn't you?
Exactly.
And so excited when you head to Milan because you pick out some pretty good stuff. So we're going to imagine we're back on the plane heading out to Milan. And you've just picked up all the newspapers. What was the coverage that you found there? What's occupying them?
I always look at the culture pages, of course. And by the way, I have to say, Milano was sunny, 20 degrees. It was t-shirt weather.
Okay,
that's very nice,
Faye.
As well.
Yeah, thank
and,
you.
And I went to the edicolas. I bought Il 24 Ore, La Repubblica. And there's so much happening in the city. Of course, Salone del Mobile is happening next month. So, of course, the city will be even busier. But if I may say some recommendations from me and from the paper as well. Guy Bourdin, one of my favorite photographers of all time. There's a lovely exhibition about his work at the Armani Silos. If no one has been there, you should go. It's a fashion art museum, of course, by Giorgio Armani. So if you're a fan of his clothes as well, there's an amazing catalog. But Guy Bourdin, he's amazing. The hyper-realistic colors and his work for magazines like Vogue Paris and more is quite sexy, but also there's a mystery touch to it. I mean, he was quite a big fan of Alfred Hitchcock, and you can see that in his pictures as well.
Okay. Bringing us newspapers and culture in one marvellous package. Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, thank you so much. That's all we have time for today's edition of The Briefing. Many thanks to my guests and to our producers, Paige Reynolds and researcher Andre Nikolai Parmintian. And our studio manager was Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Adam Heaton. The Briefing is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.